Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson. In this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Nir Eyal, the best-selling author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. Nir holds an MBA from the Stanford Graduate School of Business, where he's also been a guest lecturer. Nir is a behavior investigator, angel investor, and entrepreneur who's worked with companies like Eventbrite and Product Hunt. Nir started two tech companies himself, one of which was a gaming company that got acquired. On top of all of this, Nir somehow finds time to sit down and write about psychology, technology, and business on his blog, nirandfar.com. And that's spelled Nir like his first name, N-I-R, and far.com. In this episode, we're talking about the core components of what it takes to build a habit-forming business using the principles from Nir's book, Hooked. We're diving into how Nir and several of the entrepreneurs he's mentored go about validating their ideas before investing heavily into any new potential businesses. We cover product design, creating behavioral triggers, examples of successful triggers out there in the real world, and the art and science of persuasion, and so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Nir Eyal. Nir, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
All right. So let's jump straight into it. Can you take me back to the days before you were an author, an advisor, an investor, all these titles, and tell me a little bit about your own personal experience in the world of business?
Sure. So before I started on my current path of researching and writing and consulting around how products become habit-forming, I started two tech companies myself. So that's kind of where I discovered a lot of the problems that I write about today. And I know how hard it is to make something that people want. I mean, I feel that frustration intimately of when you have something that you know your customers would love if they just use it. And that's a big part of what drives me to do the work I do today, is that I felt that frustration my last two companies personally. So my last company is at the intersection of gaming and advertising, and I saw and I used, and at times I rejected a lot of these techniques that are used to persuade people online. And that's really what my work has been about to date over the past 4 years or so since my last company was acquired, is really about these techniques that we can use to help people stay engaged with our products and services that help them, that do good for them.
Right. And so, like, one of the core concepts I really liked in Hooked, especially in the context of building products specifically that people are going to love, is this equation you came up with, right? And it's behavior equals motivation times ability times trigger. And I want you to explain that real quick for our listeners, if you could.
Sure. So I can't take credit from that, actually. That's BJ Fogg, who's a researcher at Stanford. And so his model is based actually on the work of Lewin. And Lewin's equation says something quite similar, that says that behavior is a function of the person in their environment. And that we know that's true, but we also don't give credit to how true that is, that the environment portion turns out to have a great impact on our daily decisions. That when you think that you make your decisions because that's what you really like, that your preferences, that you have some kind of innate desire one way or the other to do things, it turns out that's not very true. That there really is no concept of self. There isn't a prescribed soul that makes you like certain things. All these things are programmed into you based on your environment and this concept of what we call mimetic desire, that we like the things that other people teach us to like. So the concept of B equals MAT is this really simple and yet powerful formula that if you're looking to get someone to do any given singular behavior, you have to have three things at the same time. The person has to have sufficient motivation. They have to have sufficient ability. That's the A. The A stands for ability, how easy or difficult something is to do. And the T stands for trigger. So B equals MAT, motivation, ability, and a trigger, according to Fogg's model. So anytime a behavior doesn't occur, if you're building a product or service, and for one reason or another, the person isn't doing the thing you want them to do, there are only three reasons why. Either they lack motivation, the behavior is too difficult to do because they lack ability, or they don't have a clear trigger present. Now, people tend to think, 9 times out of 10, as a product designer, people tend to think that people aren't doing a particular behavior because they lack motivation. And so what they tend to do is they tend to try and educate and give them texts and videos to watch. And they persuade and they say, look, if they only knew why this product would be good for them, then they would use it. And motivation, in my experience, tends to be the last reason that people don't do a particular behavior. 9 times out of 10, motivation is not the problem. Now, sometimes it is. Sometimes people just don't want to do the thing you want them to do. But much more often, the problem is that they don't have a clear trigger that tells them what action to take, and or they lack ability. Doing the behavior is too difficult to do because it's too physically difficult. It requires too much money, time, physical effort, brain cycles. This is a big one I see probably the majority of the time, is that people want to do the thing, they just can't figure out how to do it. And that's where good design, the principles of good design, are really put to use. Is you can dramatically increase the likelihood of something occurring just by making it easier to do. I can't overemphasize that point.
Right. And so assuming that someone has the ability and the motivation to engage with your product, how then do you go about creating a trigger? What would be an example of some triggers that, say, popular companies are using today?
Right. So external triggers are things that give you some kind of information for what to do. Click here, buy now, play this. A friend through word of mouth can also be an external trigger. The way to make sure you're crafting good external triggers is to make sure they're very clear, they're very visible, but also very well timed. And let me talk about this point for just a quick second. You know, Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, is famous for telling people who are in the Y Combinator program, these startups like Airbnb and many others that have gone through the Y Combinator program, his mantra is to make stuff people want. Sounds pretty simple. But I actually think that he missed a part. And so what I want to add to his mantra is my corollary, that if you want to make things people want, you have to give it to them when they want it. Super important. Let me give you a quick illustration of the point. I was on a flight recently, coming back from New York to San Francisco. And while I was on this flight, there was a gentleman across the aisle from me. I was sitting in the aisle seat. There was a gentleman right across from me, and he was sleeping. He had his blanket curled up, and he was on his pillow, clearly asleep. The flight attendant comes by with the rolling the cart and looks at the gentleman and says, "Sir," and he's sleeping. She says again, she says, "Sir," a little louder. Still, he's sleeping. Finally, she kind of almost yells and she says, "Sir." And he kind of wakes up. He says, "What is it?" And she says, "What do you want to drink?" I mean, it's laughable, right? And we product people do this all the time. We tell people, buy our product. Here's what we got. Here's what we got. And even if they want the product, think about this. That guy would have loved a beer or a glass of wine at some point, but not when he was sleeping, right? And so the core, and I see this all the time, that product makers design products that people really do want, but they don't put any effort into thinking, when do they want it? And that brings me to this concept of what I call an internal trigger. You know, the ultimate goal of a habit-forming product is to no longer need those external triggers at all. The core of my book is about how to build a product or service that people turn to on their own without spammy advertising, without expensive marketing, that people automatically remember just the way you would check Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or YouTube or WhatsApp or Slack. You do that on your own. Why? Because that product is attached inside your brain to this internal trigger. And crafting that or figuring out what that internal trigger is and crafting that coupling of the internal trigger and external trigger together is all about timing. You've got to figure out the context of when and where is your user when they most likely need that product. And that's when you send the external trigger.
I like that a lot. Something that a ton of people get wrong. Especially when we're here the first, second week after the holidays, and I'm getting tons of sales emails from companies still. They're bombarding me with sale messaging, motivate, 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 when I'm not ready to buy, right?
Right.
And so shifting gears real quick, one of the core principles I know that you've talked about, and we're also covering in this course, is the importance of building a minimum viable product, a proof of concept. And I know you've worked with a lot of cool startups, Product Hunt being one of them. In your experience or with the startups you've worked with, what makes a good MVP?
A good MVP is one that gives you answers. That's the point of a minimum viable product, is to put in the minimum amount of time, money, effort, blood, sweat, and tears to get you some kind of answer. And that answer, just as often as the answer to an MVP is go, it should also be no go. That's great. There's nothing wrong with the answer to your question of, is this viable? Should I keep going with this project? If the answer is no, that's great. You just saved yourself the most precious resource an entrepreneur has, which is time. You can always make more money. You can't get your time back. So that's really the purpose of building these MVPs. Now, where the hook model fits in to the process of making an MVP, what I recommend, I'm still a big proponent of the lean startup methodologies. And at my last two companies, we use the lean startup methodology, hook, line, and sinker. I mean, I love it. But if you think about those three basic steps of the lean startup as espoused by Eric Ries and Steve Blank, it's three basic steps, right? You have to build, then measure, then learn. That's the lean startup cycle. Build, measure, and learn. It's fantastic. Much better than, you know, the waterfall process we used to use to build software. But there is one part of those three that requires a disproportionate amount of money, time, and effort. And that one phase is the building phase, right? It's only the building phase that requires all that money, the blood, sweat, and tears, and all that effort all goes into building. Measuring and learning is easy. Once you have the infrastructure to measure and learn, that's a joke. That's the fun part. It's building that can take years and millions of dollars. And so what I propose is that before you build, before you spend a dime on building the product, if your product requires a habit, if you need that product to be used on its own, right? People coming back on their own, the way that they would pick up Facebook or Twitter or Instagram on their own. If that's the kind of product you need, it behooves you to take just a few minutes sometimes and ask yourself these five fundamental questions that are embedded in the hook model. And this is something that you can do with pen and paper. You don't need any fancy technology. God forbid you write any code to do this. All you have to do is ask these five fundamental questions that I talk about in my book that verify whether your product has the bones, the structure of a product that can build a habit. And if it doesn't, you're going to know that right away. And if that means you kill the project, fine. If that means you say, hey, you know what? We're not that far off. Here's our weak points. That's really what we should go test first. Then hallelujah. Now you know what to actually spend your time working on and validating, as opposed to kind of running around willy-nilly.
So have you had any validation tests of your own, or have you seen any that completely exploded? And then what did you do, or what did they do after that?
Well, you top of mind is Product Hunt, because you mentioned Product Hunt. So Product Hunt was started by a good friend of mine, a guy by the name of Ryan Hoover. Funny story. So Ryan Hoover actually reached out to me back in 2012. Yeah, late 2012. A buddy of mine sent me Ryan's blog post. It was called 13 People I Want to Meet in 2013. Okay. And I was on that list. And it was like, you know, kind of Silicon Valley people like Kevin Rose and Eric Ries. And like, you know, so somebody sent me this and said, eh, funny, look, you're on this list that this guy put together. By the way, at that time, nobody knew who Ryan Hoover was. This was years before Product Hunt was created. And I just reached out to Ryan and said, hey, look, you know, let me check myself off the list. Come down and let's have a burger together. So we did. And Ryan says to me, look, you know, I've got some extra time on my hands. I really like what you do. I've been reading your blog posts for a few years now. How can I help? So I said, you know what, Ryan, I have these blog posts that I really want to put together into a book. Okay. I want to put together this little book. Can you help me do that? Ryan said, sure. We took a couple months and he took all my blog posts and he put them in a big long Google Doc and we started working on it to massage what eventually became my book Hooked. And on the cover of my book today, it says Near Eyal with Ryan Hoover. The next thing Ryan does after we work together is he started this experiment called Startup Letters, where he started sending out this email that you would get, I think, maybe like once or twice a week around startup topics. And a big part of it was new products and services that were launching that you missed on TechCrunch. Back then, a product launch, the protocol to launch your product was to beg and plead some reporter at TechCrunch to tell the world about your product. Well, he started getting traction with this email list. And then he comes to me and he shows me this hook, right? Nobody knows the hook model second to me better than Ryan. And so he showed me the hook model that he was going to build for his future product that came out of Startup Letters, which would eventually be called Product Hunt. And so that core hook, I mean, I don't know about you, I check my Product Hunt email every single day. It's something that I do with little or no conscious thought. I can't help but open that email every day. It's a habit today. And I think that's a real testament to him being so diligent in his application of some of these methodologies.
Yeah, totally. I'm still completely hooked on it. And so on that note, he had to start somewhere, right? Do you know exactly how Ryan got started? How did he get those first, say, 100 or 1,000 people on what would have been his newsletter back then?
Oh, it was just his friends. It was people like me. It was just buddies. Now, Ryan, one of the rules of starting a company that I actually learned too late is that there has to be, as well as a product market fit, there has to be a product founder fit. I think that's super important. It's not discussed enough that I thought my first two companies, I did because of the money. I'll be totally honest with you. I just saw money and an opportunity and I jumped at it. I think that was suboptimal because you can only go so far. You eventually run out of gas if the reason you do it is for money. And frankly, if you start a company for the money, you're just bad at math. Because the odds of success are puny, right? Like you're much better off working pretty much any other job because your odds of making it big are just so tiny. Now, on the other hand, if you build something that you want to see in the world, that you are passionate about, that even if the product didn't achieve financial success, you would be happy knowing that you create a product that serves your needs, you can't lose. Right? How can you fail? You might not make money, but you're not going to fail because you will have fundamentally built a product that you as the user need. It also gives you a tremendous competitive advantage. Now, I talk about this in more depth in the book, but if you look at companies like Facebook and Instagram and Google and all of these companies were built by people who fundamentally wanted the product themselves. And I think Ryan Hoover is no exception. They had a perfect fit with the product. And if you look at somebody like Ryan, I mean, nobody else could have built Product Hunt. He embodies the product. It is him. Now, Product Hunt obviously can run without Ryan now because now it's built this machine. But there was an amazing fit. I mean, he was the kind of guy that was just everywhere. He loves, eats, breathes, and sleeps technology products. And so there was a perfect fit with the founder in that case.
Totally. Do you have any tips or piece of advice for people who are maybe actually not quite sure whether or not the idea they have in mind is going to be the best fit for specifically them to pursue?
Yeah. So it really has to be something. So I give this two-part test in my book. I call it the manipulation matrix because I'll back up a little bit. A lot of times when people read my book, they say, this feels slimy, like, you know, using people's hidden psychology to persuade them to do things. Is that ethical? Is that manipulation? And it is manipulation. And it can be used ethically. Now, it can also be used unethically, right? If you trick people, if you coerce them to do things they don't want to do, that's unethical. But persuading people is perfectly ethical. We love to be persuaded. We love to be manipulated. If you think about when you go to watch a movie, you know that on that screen, that's just flickering light. That's not real people. And even if it was, it's actors that aren't experiencing the emotions that they portray, right? It's a complete lie. You're being manipulated, but we love it. We love feeling those emotions. We'll pay for the privilege. But that's something we want to do. And I think that we persuading people to do things they want to do, particularly when it comes to these products and services using this methodology, helping people exercise more, live healthier, connect with people they love, learn more, save money, all of these things through good product design can be used to improve people's lives. And so those are the kind of services I love to see use this kind of methodology I described in Hooked. Now, the test, there's a two-part test. If you want to ask yourself, how do I know if I'm using this stuff ethically? There's a two-part test that is built for the product maker. It's not meant for you to judge other people or other people to judge you, but this is for you to ask yourself, are you spending your limited time on Earth in the best way possible? And here's the two-part test. The first question is to look at yourself in the mirror and ask yourself, is what I'm working on materially improving people's lives? Okay, that's just a question, and only you can answer that, right? What does material mean? I don't know. You have to answer that question. So is this product materially improving people's lives? But that's not good enough. Here's the second question. The second question is, am I the user? Now, why do I ask that question? Let me ask you, Ryan, do you know the first rule of drug dealing? What's the first rule of drug dealing?
I would say, don't smoke your own stuff.
Don't get high on your own supply. That's exactly right. The first rule of drug dealing is never get high on your own supply. So the reason I make that rule is that if there are any deleterious effects to building your habit-forming product, guess who's going to find out about it? You are. And that's how we safeguard against the inappropriate use of these products and services, is that if you are building a product that you believe materially improves people's lives and you're the user, I say go for it. That's free reign. And if you look at, like, as I mentioned before, all of the people that built these products, these world-changing companies like Google and Facebook and Instagram and Slack and WhatsApp, every single one of them met that two-part test. They were building for themselves something that they believe materially improves people's lives. And it's a tremendous competitive advantage. Just the last point here is that if you think about what's the hardest part about building a product or service, it's knowing what the user needs. And so what a lot of times founders will do is they'll say, I'm going to build a product for big brand advertisers because I think there's a lot of money there. Well, have you ever been in advertising? Have you ever worked for P&G or Coca-Cola? Have you ever bought ads online in massive scale? No. Well, then you don't understand what your customer needs. But if you build for yourself, you at least have the advantage of intimately understanding one user, yourself. And that is actually a huge competitive advantage that we should not take for granted.
Nir, I want to be respectful of your time. I have one last quick question for you. So here in San Francisco, we're all super addicted to transportation apps like Uber, Lyft, that make our lives so incredibly convenient. Every time I need to go somewhere, my first thought is I need to get my Uber ready, right? And so I'm curious to hear if you have any recommendations on other apps or websites or services that are doing a particularly great job today of hooking their users and satisfying their demands that you would recommend people checking out who want to see sort of the Hooked process in real life.
Well, I think, you know, these aren't new or, you know, these recommendations aren't necessarily brand new products and services. I mean, I think if you look at Facebook, I think very few people understand the power of these methodologies better than Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, if you think about the fact that people like Mark Zuckerberg, his before he dropped out of Harvard, he had two majors. One was computer science. You know what the other one was?
I don't.
Psychology. And Kevin Systrom, one of the founders of Instagram, at Stanford, he majored in symbolic systems. Symbolic systems is 50% computer science, 50% psychology. Reid Hoffman, same story, symbolic systems majors. These people understand what makes you tick because they want to understand what makes you click. And that's at the core of these products. So when you think about LinkedIn, Instagram, WhatsApp, Slack, amazing example within Slack, all of these products, if you analyze how they are made, what the user experience is all about, all of these products have a very clear hook.
Awesome. Thanks, Nir. Can you go ahead and tell our viewers where they can find you online?
Sure. So my book is called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. That's available on Amazon or wherever books are sold. By the way, Amazon, an amazingly habit-forming product, as we've seen over time. I mean, they are masters of habit formation. We could talk about that more next time. And then my blog is nearandfar.com. And near is spelled like my first name, nirandfar.com, nearandfar.com.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ryan. We'll be right back.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.